This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of June, and we got a jobs report that showed job growth improved in May compared to April, but was still slower than expected. The U.S. added 559,000 jobs in May, leaving us still 7.6 million jobs short of where we were before the pandemic. Wage growth beat expectations again, reflecting employers' desire to hire workers. But that's not translating into the accelerated job creation that a lot of economists have been looking for. To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. On the right, I'm joined by Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Josh.
And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Josh.
Liz, are these numbers a problem? Is this recovery going as well as it ought to be?
I don't think we have a good map for how this recovery should be going, because I don't think we have in modern times, at least, intentionally turned the economy off and turned it back on again. This isn't a typical recession. This was something we did intentionally to try to stop the spread of a disease. And so I think to the degree that we're seeing slow returns, it's something that, you know, is obviously worrisome, something that we probably don't need to worry too much about yet. I think to the degree that workers are feeling it possible to be a little bit picky about what jobs they take coming back to the labor market, I'm not too worried about that. I actually think that might be a good thing. And I hope that it drives wages up. And I'm pleased with the wage growth.
So we all kind of share a general premise here about the unemployment that Liz just referred to, the sort of special extra federal unemployment on top of the state unemployment, that in extraordinary times, it's actually good to help people not rush back into a job, especially a job that might not be a good fit. If the jobs are coming back in hospitality, but you work in manufacturing, there's some cost to the economy of people just rushing back into the first job that opens. But the minor premise of this argument is the question is, are we still in those extraordinary times? And the fact is, basically everybody, every adult who wants a vaccine has a vaccine. The economy is opening much faster today than we thought even, or it's trying to open much faster today than we thought it was going to even a month ago. And, you know, I like to go to local bars, both in downtown D.C. and where I live in Silver Spring. And in both of them, the manager comes up to me and says, I would love to hire people, but this extra federal $300 on top of the state unemployment makes it impossible for me to get people to work for me. And so the question is, are we ready to sort of say to the local pub, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to be in business because you don't pay your people enough, your margins aren't high enough. I think that we can't avoid the fact that in many cases, this extra $300 from the federal government is keeping people from going to work in a way that hurts the economy and hurts communities by closing down small businesses.
You know, it's been really interesting to me watching businesses open back up. I live in New York, and restaurants were open through the pandemic for takeout, and we had a huge expansion in outdoor dining. But as there's been this scaling back up and the return to normal, it's clear to me that places are short-staffed, and they're not operating the way they used to. But some of that really seems to be flowing through as changes to business models that I think are broadly positive ones, which is to say, you know, menus are shorter so that service is simpler, so that you can serve the same number of people with fewer workers. It also reduces your food costs. We're seeing restaurants continuing to use those digital menus, in some cases taking orders on the phone. You pay on your phone, and that means the waiter doesn't have to come to the table as many times, and that means that you can do more service with fewer workers. And obviously, we don't want that to mean fewer total aggregate jobs in the economy. But what I'm seeing there is those businesses adapting to the fact that it's hard to hire for a number of reasons and saying, well, let's get more productive. Let's find a way to do business with fewer workers than we used to. And among the benefits of that is that a business with higher productivity like that can afford to pay more. And so I think to some extent, we're seeing some structural changes in the economy from things that we learned through the pandemic, or because, as Liz notes, you know, people came out of this and said, you know, do I really want to do this thing at $12 an hour that I used to do? And I think some of those adaptations could actually be really positive in the long run. And I think part of that, you know, if you're going to have those sorts of big changes, it makes sense that it's going to take some time for all the jobs to come back, because businesses need to find new ways to operate. People need to find new things to do. And so we still have hundreds of thousands of people re-entering employment every month. But if it's not just that we've had this huge disruption in society, but some things are changing forever, I look at this and I've been feeling more sanguine than I was a few months ago about this pace, basically saying, you know, we're really changing a lot. And I kind of think it's okay if that changes. It takes a while, because I think a lot of those changes are really going to improve the way work works in the United States in the long run.
I think there are positives. People learning to actually work from home. I mean, people got better at it over the last few years. So office jobs, that sort of thing. If more of those can work from home, it creates a flexibility. What I'm hoping to see more of is more sort of work from home that is very clearly part-time, that you can say, you know, Mondays and Fridays, I'm checked out. Or, you know what, 3 o'clock, I'm picking up my kids, and I'm totally checked out at that point. And so there will be, anytime something bad happens that we have to adjust from, we learn something from it. But it, to me, again, it's unavoidable to say that paying people not to work, that's obviously keeping people off the sidelines. And it's another argument for federalism, right? Different states are making up their minds. Here in Maryland, our governor, Larry Hogan, very good governor, decided to end it come July 1st. We're not going to have that extra $300. And you can look around Maryland and see that, you know, the businesses are open and are trying to open and the job market is tight. In another state, it might be a different story, and a different governor can make a different decision. I think it's a great argument in favor of the way we do it now, where the states actually carry out and administer the unemployment benefits.
Liz, I think it's interesting. We're having this conversation at a time that we have negotiations ongoing in Washington for a very large infrastructure package. And now I'd note that the package is supposed to be, and they're still writing it, obviously, but it's supposed to be spent over 8 years. So the idea is not that you put trillions of dollars out and you try to do all the construction right away. But it's a big increase in the amount of physical investment that we would be doing over the medium term at a time when employers are finding it somewhat difficult to hire, and they're also finding it somewhat difficult to acquire materials. We're seeing big increases in prices for lumber, which has come down some but is still very elevated, for steel, things like that. Does this adjust your view at all on whether this is really time for a big infrastructure package at a time when you have businesses both saying, well, it's already hard for me to hire, and also saying, you know, it's hard for me to buy lumber and to buy steel, and so what are those prices going to do if the government decides that this is exactly the right time to increase its construction of highways and bridges and those sorts of things?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are considerations you have to think about when you're doing any kind of massive infrastructure investment. But at the same time, you know, the counterbalance to that is, do we really need the infrastructure investment right now? And I think a lot of signs point to yes. So if the lack of infrastructure or the instability or unevenness nationwide in infrastructure is leading to significant problems, then that may counterbalance the, you know, challenges that would be presented in trying to purchase large quantities of raw materials or to get, to buy a lot of labor at once. At the same time, I still don't really think it's that big of a problem that businesses might have to bid up somewhat, or the federal government might have to bid up somewhat for labor. I think that's historically sort of been a good thing, especially in the case of the federal government, in getting the United States out of difficult economic situations. It could be a pretty healthy jumpstart, as a matter of fact. So, I'm cautiously optimistic about that. Let's put it that way.
So again, there's two different questions, right? And I mean, infrastructure now means everything, right? If you're a Democrat, you know, abortion becomes infrastructure. But there are actual needs, but every government spending bill turns into an effort to also fulfill other perceived social goods. And one social good, and Liz is absolutely right, is employing people and driving up wages. That should never be the primary goal, though, of an infrastructure bill. But if you're going to make that be a secondary goal, there's a lot better argument for it in the time that Obama did his stimulus in 2009 than there is now, because you were helping unemployed people. You were applying upward pressure to sagging wages. And there's an inefficiency to doing it now. My wife and I want to screen porch because we don't like mosquitoes biting our kids while we're eating outside, but now's not the time to build a screen porch. And so we should do all the infrastructure that needs to be done, but to do extra infrastructure at a time when we have these shortages is very inefficient, and it's not a time when American workers, especially construction workers, are in a special need of employment. It's quite the opposite. Let's save up and do it when next time the recession comes around.
What do we make of the talks that are ongoing right now? President Biden keeps meeting with Shelley Moore Capito, who's a Republican senator from West Virginia, who's the Republican point person on infrastructure talks. And they've been back and forth both on spending, where, you know, as Tim notes, there are disagreements about what constitutes infrastructure. Both the Democrats have wanted a very large investment in home health care, which is not even physical investment. But then there are also certain other kinds of physical investment, like housing, that are not typically considered infrastructure. So there's debate about what kinds of things should be in the bill, but also probably even bigger is how big the bill should be. Nominally, the parties are separated by about $700 billion on that. The Republican proposal is almost a trillion. The Biden proposal has come down to about $1.7 trillion, but that sort of obscures Republicans are counting money that we'd already be spending anyway on infrastructure through other avenues. So really, they're apart by more than $1 trillion. Tim, are these productive conversations? Are there things for Republicans and the president to discuss that are likely to actually lead to some sort of bipartisan agreement on this?
First of all, I like debate. That's one of the reasons I like this show, Josh. And too many times when, you know, there's a bill like this, there's this scolding from the media. Oh, come on, guys, get together and pass a plan. And, well, maybe we actually disagree about the threat of inflation from massive federal spending. Maybe we disagree about deficits and debt. And maybe we disagree about what it's proper for the federal government to be funding. And so I do think these debates are productive. But I also think that in the last 15 years, sort of both parties have come to realize that when you're out of power, simply blocking everything might be politically the prudent move to do. And I think that the Democrats are now seeing Shelley Moore Capito getting her on board is the way to get Joe Manchin on board. And that's what they're trying to do, that to pass something through reconciliation process, a budget reconciliation process that avoids a filibuster. You don't actually need Republicans. You need Joe Manchin. And the way to get Joe Manchin is to get his fellow West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito. So that's the process. I think it's a smart move by the Democrats. But this debate is not simply people being obstructionists. There's also real disagreements about the federal role and the threat of overspending right now.
Liz, it's interesting what Tim mentions there about Capito and Joe Manchin, because I'm hearing a lot of discontent from progressives about that Biden is spending all this time trying to negotiate with Republicans, comparing it to 2009 when you had Republicans basically stringing Barack Obama along for a long time with the idea that there could possibly be a bipartisan agreement on healthcare law before Obama went ahead and did a Democratic-only bill. So there's sort of a, you know, let's get on with it. Let's just go and do a bill through the budget reconciliation process, which only takes 50 votes and therefore only takes Democratic votes. But as Tim gets it there, you need all 50 Democrats if you're going to do that. You need Joe Manchin. You need Kyrsten Sinema. And so it's not obvious that Biden has the ability to move, you know, most or all of what he wants on infrastructure through that method before you even get into what you can actually are allowed to do through budget reconciliation. So is Biden playing this well? Is negotiating with Republicans the play that he needs to make here?
I mean, I think it's difficult to say. It's going to come down to specific Republicans and what they're worried about establishing with their constituencies. Manchin and Sinema have turned out to be sort of wild card. I mean, not that wild, because I think they're pretty predictable, but they're not reliable Democratic votes, let's put it that way. And so Biden doesn't have this block he can rely on. So he's going to have to periodically rely on Republican defectors. And sometimes you can do that. There are Republicans that Democrats like to think of as potential defectors, Murkowski, Collins, etc. But I don't think they're reliable defectors either. So it's going to come down to just making those situational calls with particular bills. Who do you think you can peel off? I think it makes sense to try to get Manchin more on board. I think he's open to that. I think Biden is the kind of Democrat who you can see making more regular deals with Manchin. And I think it makes sense to try to get Sinema as on board as you can, although I have a hard time making sense of her politics. But, you know, that's the position Biden is in. And I think it's critical for him, and his mandate is to some degree to try to participate in more bipartisanship than your average Democratic or Republican president, precisely because people seem extremely wary at this point of the level of polarization and the level of malice in the polarization that we've got going on right now.
One thing I can't fully make sense of, or I can't fully develop a view on as I look at these negotiations, is normally we sort of assume that if you have two sides and there's some distance between them on what they want to do on an issue, that a compromise should be expected to land, you know, somewhere approximately in the middle of their two positions. But of course, it can't always work exactly like that, because if that was how it worked, then you could just up your ask however high as was necessary, such that the midpoint between your ask and the other side's ask is what you were actually looking for to begin with. And so it's just because Biden proposed over $2 trillion, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, if there's going to be a bipartisan deal, it should land right around a trillion or a little bit more than a trillion. And so on one level, the last Republican offer that's really only about $250 billion in new money, you could say that looks like an insult, or that it looks like a ridiculous response that's you know, nowhere in the ballpark. It's like offering $100,000 for a house that's listed at $700,000. But I'm not sure it's actually like that. I try to think about what could you really do in a reconciliation bill that you'd line up all 50 Democratic votes for? How big could that bill be? What could it really encompass? I think that might be so far off from Biden's opening bid that it ends up being worth doing a deal with Republicans that looks drastically different from what he proposed originally. And of course, the good thing about it being an 8-year infrastructure package is you can always come back and do more in the future if it's appropriate in the future to spend more money. The negotiations look at first glance like they should be sort of dead because the sides are so far apart. But I think that there might be more reason for Biden to take a much smaller loaf than you'd expect in these negotiations. But I think that's going to be a rude awakening for a lot of liberals if they end up doing an infrastructure package here that's really only $300 or $400 billion of new money. And it's all in very traditional infrastructure areas such as roads and bridges and maybe some power grid stuff. I think that's likely to be disappointing to liberals who saw the last round of relief get done and Biden get substantially everything that he had asked for in the beginning except the minimum wage increase. I don't think that you can expect that every future negotiation is going to end up looking like that one.
I'll just add that the Republicans' advantage here is that if you pass nothing, you get nothing. So if Biden wants something, cutting a deal, somehow getting to 50 votes, the negotiating advantage is in the hands of the guys who say, well, if you want something, we're giving you something smaller. Is that better than nothing?
I'll be back with Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner and Liz Brunig of The Atlantic to talk about the return of cruises. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. This weekend, the first big ship Caribbean cruise since the COVID-driven cruising shutdown is setting sail. The Celebrity Millennium can hold over 2,000 passengers, and it starts its first post-COVID voyage this Saturday, but not from the United States. It's going to sail from St. Martin. U.S.-based cruising is supposed to begin later this month, but there is a political snag. Florida is by far the largest U.S. cruise embarkation point, and the CDC says that cruise lines must ensure that at least 95% of passengers and 95% of crew are vaccinated in order to sail from the U.S. But Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a state law that prohibits private companies from requiring proof of vaccination from their customers. DeSantis is suing the CDC, and he's warning cruise lines they'll be fined if they follow the CDC rules. And that has Florida's cruise industry in limbo. The CEO of Norwegian Cruise Lines even said they can just sail from Caribbean ports if Florida proves to be a problem. Tim, what DeSantis is doing here seems like part of a major shift in how conservatives think about freedom. It's not just about freedom from the government. He's saying private companies may not set rules that impact individuals in ways that I don't like. You can see it in the fight over social media moderation, which we talked about on this show last week. And you can see it here with this rule of no vaccine passports, which isn't just about when the federal government's trying to require the vaccine passports. It's also a prohibition on purely private enterprise decisions to require proof of vaccination. So what's the deal with this concept of liberty? When should the government be interfering to stop private entities from imposing requirements on private persons?
There has been a real shift, and I've said on this show before, that Republicans, conservatives have changed. They sort of feel like they lost the debate. For years, we just said, look, a private business should get to do what it wants. And then, you know, if you were talking about not catering a gay wedding, if you were talking about whatever, and then immediately the argument would go back to black people being denied a seat at the counter. And every time you said, well, if a private business wants to set a different set of rules, it should be able to, that didn't catch on with the elite media. And frankly, most of the public wasn't totally on board. You see it today with masks. One of the biggest arguments I hear about masking now is it's too unclear and inconsistent. I don't know. Why am I allowed to not wear a mask in Giant, but I have to wear a mask in Safeway or whatever? People kind of want consistent rules. And so the idea, the argument, let private businesses do what they want. And if you don't like it, you can go to another one. A lot of conservatives feel, well, we didn't win on that, so we're going to stop playing by that rule if the other side isn't going to play by that rule. So that's how I see Ron DeSantis's action. The left has always said, if we know what's right, and we're going to make private businesses play by those rules. And the right used to say, well, what I would say, Josh, is I don't think these cruise lines should have a vaccine mandate, but it's up to them. That's seen as sort of wussing out, because we know the other side wouldn't play by those rules anymore.
Liz, is there a relevant liberty interest here that you see? Should the government be making rules about when private entities can require proof of vaccination?
Yeah, of course. And I don't take a particular side. I'm a leftist. There's no left party in the United States. Look, the idea of quarantine itself was developed around boats, which are just floating disease bombs, because they put creatures, human and animal, in close proximity with no escape. They have always been vectors of virulent plague. They are horrible, horrible institutes. I don't know what would possess anyone to go on a cruise. But anyway, if you're going to do that, the very institute of quarantine arose from, I believe, Venetian authorities during the Black Death, forcing boats to wait in dock for 40 days to see if people on them were going to die in huge numbers. And it could have been a completely different pestilence than the Black Death. It could have well been cholera. Many, many types of plague wash ashore on these horrible vessels all over the world historically. And the coronavirus is just yet another in human history that we, you know, risk exporting all over the world as we try to stamp it out. So I think it makes perfect sense from a public health point of view to say, if we're all going to crowd onto boats and go to other countries which may have this virus under control or at a manageable level, let's make sure that we're not exporting a bioweapon. And we can do that by making sure that people who get aboard are vaccinated. This is a public health issue. Public health only works if everybody has to participate. It does not work if individuals opt in. That's not how public health works.
But so I guess you make what I think is a strong argument that cruises are an environment where it is especially sensible to impose vaccine requirements, because it's so easy to spread diseases in close quarters on a cruise ship. I'd also note it's an environment where it's relatively easy to enforce a vaccine requirement. The same people are on the cruise for a week. They already have to provide all sorts of other documents, including a literal passport, in order to get on the cruise. And so right. It's administrable to do that requirement. Are there other places, because DeSantis has been trying to do this all over the economy, are there other places where you're sympathetic at all to his saying, basically, you know, well, this other place where you might go, the contact is so incidental, or it's so important that children be able to access it before they can be vaccinated, or that sort of thing? Is he right to be trying to impose restrictions in at least certain parts of the economy on the ability to say, show me your vaccine card?
Yeah, I mean, if I can't find you, like if you're just running around in a field or something, then fine. But, you know, if you're going to school, we already ask that you be vaccinated, for instance. Now, children are a different story in this case, right? Because they seem to be a relatively low risk vector. But if you're teachers and you're going back to teach at a school, you should be vaccinated. If you're going into a movie theater, again, any place that human beings are going to pack in together like sardines, you probably need to be vaccinated. That makes sense to me. And, you know, someone else, some other risk actuary, can measure out the harms versus the benefits of particular venues, but I think that math can probably be
done. No, I mean, the math has to include the fact that coronavirus right now in the United States is not an epidemic, really. I mean, the case numbers are falling. They're falling dramatically. We have a vast majority of adults have gotten a shot. In lots of parts of the country, you're up to 70% are fully vaccinated or have at least one shot. And that among children, it has not proved to be very deadly, very dangerous thing. Schools were very safe this year. And so it's different than measles. I mean, I wouldn't send my kids to a school that allowed large numbers to be unvaccinated against the measles. And I'm glad that the teachers at my kids' schools got vaccinated against coronavirus for their protection, that children are not particularly at risk from this, that the virus is largely disappearing. Will it flare up again in the fall is another question. But also the other thing is that the coronavirus vaccines were approved on an emergency basis. There was an emergency. That emergency has passed. We haven't gotten full FDA approval. To say we're going to have an expedited process for approving this vaccine was great. But there should be a time between when we say you can get this vaccine and you have to get this vaccine. That's where we are now. I'm not saying it would never be appropriate to require these for all sorts of settings. But right now, it seems with very low prevalence and with the drugs still being new, it seems that humility would have us say we want everybody to get it, but we're not going to make people get it.
But that is what I'm saying. And it seems like my sense is that the crisis, the pressure has come off of the pandemic because the vaccines have been working for large part. And so it seems like, you know, we keep our foot on the gas moderately. I'm not an alarmist about this. I mean, I got coronavirus. My whole family did. And that's because we, you know, largely weren't shut-ins during the pandemic. You have to take some reasonable risks, and we did, and we got it, and that was unfortunate, and we quarantined and so forth, and now we've been vaccinated as well. But, you know, I think trying to limit exposure to risk at the tail end of this thing while we manage it on its way out, it's, you know, within reason, I think, you know, I understand why the CDC is aiming at that.
But movie theaters have almost no spread. I mean, I think I agree on the general premise. Again, we go case by case. You could probably persuade me on cruise ships, certainly on hospitals, but certainly not grocery stores. And I would say probably not movie theaters again, because there's just not great evidence of spread in those. Where the spread happened was big family Sunday dinners. and so there's just not that many public settings where I think it would make that much sense to require it, precisely because this isn't the measles. It's not going to kill off a ton of kids. It's something that's sort of under control right now.
What about in places of employment? Because I think that's the other big area where we are having and are going to be having fights about whether vaccines can be required. In the long run, I think it's impractical to have to try to scan people as they enter retail stores and movie theaters. That's a huge burden on the employees of these places and on those businesses. They don't want to be in that business. But workers go to the same place every day. It's, again, like on a cruise ship, it's relatively administrable to say, you have to prove to me that you have been vaccinated in order to work here. And we're seeing lawsuits even at hospitals and other medical places of work where workers are saying, we don't want to be subject to a vaccine requirement to work here. And we've had at least one of these outbreaks in a nursing home where you had an unvaccinated employee who got coronavirus and it ultimately ended up in a large number of patients, some of them vaccinated. And because, of course, the vaccines, they work very well, but they don't work perfectly. So it seems like one of the places where the strongest argument for being able to say you must be vaccinated in order to show up here is a hospital or a nursing home. But we're seeing resistance and lawsuits even over that. And that feels to me like one of the number one places where we should be requiring it. Because, Tim, you're right. For kids, COVID really is basically just like the flu, which is not to say that it's nothing. But the risk to children is relatively low. I'm concerned about the risk to ill, frail, and elderly people, even when they've been vaccinated in these concentrated settings. And that's where I really think we do need to be requiring
So you have to ask, who is a third party you're protecting? If you're imposing something on somebody to tell somebody you have to do this, usually, not always, I mean, we require motorcycle helmets, but typically we're saying there's some third party that we're protecting. You're not just taking the risk on yourself by going unvaccinated. And I agree, especially if you're talking about the elderly. Among the breakthrough cases of vaccinated people catching coronavirus, almost without fail, are minor cases. There's approximately zero deaths in the United States of vaccinated people. Now, where they're happening is with the elderly. So if you're going to, my uncle's in a nursing home, if you're going to be serving him to require you to be vaccinated, I think is legitimate. If you're going to show up at the New York Times office or the Washington Examiner or KCRW without a vaccine, you'd have to make a specific argument for how that is really endangering somebody else. And to me, the vaccines are not 100% effective is not in itself an adequate argument, unless you can say, here's this immunocompromised colleague, or here's how we're all crowded together in a tight booth for hours at a time, all singing or shouting or whatever. You have to make a specific argument that there's a third party you're endangering by showing up to work unvaccinated.
Liz, I thought you said an interesting combination of things, because you talked about, you know, public health is something that we all have to do together. When you have a communicable disease, the policies don't work if you don't get, you know, if you don't get widespread enforcement and get everybody to participate. But you also, you talked about the very real personal sphere of risk-taking and choices that people make, even in the context of an infectious disease pandemic. The government doesn't regulate every individual aspect of people's behaviors. People are going to make different choices about what they feel about risk. And that's okay within a certain bound, even though there are externalities, and even though COVID did not create an absolute moral requirement to take every possible precaution to reduce your risk of getting COVID to zero. That would have been impractical. So I guess, how do you balance those things? Where do you determine where that sphere of personal choice ends, even when those choices have some effect on other people? How do you decide where the line is, where that effect is too large and the government needs to come in and say, no, you're not allowed to make that choice?
Yeah, I mean, it's very complicated. The list of moral decisions that are simply black and white, rules-based moral decisions that are independent of context, those are very short. That's a very short list. The number of moral decisions that are completely contextual and are going to depend quite a bit on the people involved, their specific situations, and whatever is going on in the world at the moment, that's a very long list of moral decisions. So in the case of coronavirus, there were a lot of things that made it a very unique situation. It wasn't Ebola. It didn't have an extremely high lethality rate across the board. We're a young family. I'm 30. My husband's 32. We have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. So we weren't a high-risk group to begin with. We didn't have any exposure to elderly family members. So in our immediate sphere, we thought about that, not really exposed to people who are very vulnerable to this disease. At the same time, you don't know who the people around you are being exposed to on a daily basis. So we didn't want to pick it up. At the same time, there were certain things we weren't very willing to sacrifice in order to avoid picking it up. So for instance, you could pay for a grocery delivery service like Postmates or Instacart, but that's just paying someone else, a poor person, to be exposed on your behalf. We would rather be exposed than ask that person to be exposed, considering that our risk was relatively low and we don't know that person's risk. So it's just complicated. It's difficult. It's something you just sort of sit down and game out, and in my case, pray about and ask for guidance in and reconsider every day. But in the case of where the government comes in, the government is looking at it from the view of, you know, 10,000 feet, from 300 million people and managing it on the macro level. And that has always been the government's role in terms of public health. From the government's point of view, maximal vaccine uptake and maximal management of the pandemic until it is totally negligible in the population are going to be the goals. And I understand that is a problem for commerce, but it seems like we are getting to the point where those two lines are about to cross. Commerce is getting back on its feet. The pandemic is coming to an end. It's just a matter of not getting out over our skis before those two things do intersect.
Before we break, I want to switch gears and talk about one other topic, which is Michael Flynn at a sort of QAnon-type conference last weekend in Dallas. Someone in the audience asked him basically, well, you know, there was this military coup in Myanmar. Why can't we do that here? And Flynn was like, well, that should happen here. And then we've had reporting, including from Maggie Haberman and from Charles Cook at National Review, saying that the former president seems to actually believe that he's going to be reinstated into office by August. This is what the MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell, has been saying. Also says two Republican senators who lost in the last election, they're going to get their seats back after these, you know, they examine the ballots in Phoenix and find the bamboo threads and the watermarks and all the things that prove how the election was stolen from Donald Trump and all that stuff. That's actually going to work. He's actually going to become president again, which is nuts. And again, it's, you know, as Cook emphasized, that it seems the president's not saying this to troll people. He's not saying it to raise money. He's saying it in private to people in a way that suggests he actually believes it. And I don't like to do segments where we just sit around and say, God, isn't that thing Trump said nuts? Because I don't think that's very productive. But when I look at this, Tim, you know, at some point, Republicans need to turn around and start running an election campaign for 2022. That's presumably in large part about Joe Biden and Joe Biden's agenda and why Republicans should run the government and that sort of thing. It seems like the president, who is about to go back out onto the so-called campaign trail and be giving speeches again, the former president, he seems intent on keeping the Republicans trapped in this psychodrama of his, and whatever the effects are on the Republic, it doesn't seem very useful for turning out Republican voters and electing Republican officials in elections in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that nominating and rallying behind a narcissist without good ability to grasp reality might have been a mistake for the Republican Party. And it's a mistake that they're continuing to pay the price for. I mean, Donald Trump is what we raise our children not to be. And that a lot of Republicans tried to convince themselves that his total lack of character and sort of mental acuity was something that could be gotten over if he had the right advisors, and he gave us the right judges and passed the right tax cuts. And he did give us the right judges and pass pretty good tax cuts. But it still is a huge cost, and maybe in the long run, not worth it to put this man where he is, because what he's done is he has fostered so much of a loyalty from a significant portion of the Republican base, which is a minority of the electorate, but it's important enough that so many other Republicans feel that they have to be 100% loyal to this man, and not to what he believed in, but to the man. And the man was a very worst part of the 4 years of the Trump administration. And so, I mean, it's a gift that will keep on giving to the Democrats, but I don't think Democrats should be happy about it, because it's legitimately bad for our country to have the conspiracy theories floating around and the cult of personality for one of the worst personalities out of the 330 million personalities in America.
Liz, does this worry you like Tim describes?
What an idiot. What a psycho. I mean, it's kind of amusing. It's a little bit worrisome. I hope that no more violence comes out of it. It's also just really funny. I don't know.
The pillow part really adds a humor to it.
The MyPillow guy is running the country.
Well, not yet.
We still have Joe Biden running the country, I think.
I think we can leave that there. I've been talking with Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and Liz Brunig of The Atlantic. We will be back with Patrick Sharkey of Princeton University to talk about the rise in crime rates. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Major cities across the United States continue to experience a spike in violent crime. As of May 30, New York City had had 173 murders, a 40% increase from the same period in 2019. And you see similar stories in major cities around the country, Atlanta, Chicago, many others. Overall, the New York Times estimates that there were 6.22 murders for every 100,000 people in the U.S. in 2020. That's the highest level since 1998, and it's 40% higher than when the murder rate hit bottom back in 2014. And data from cities, unfortunately, we don't get quick turnaround national data. It suggests that that murder spike is continuing into this year. So as I've watched this happen, I think I have the same questions that a lot of you do. Why is this happening? To the extent it's because of the pandemic, can we just expect this problem to go away as the country goes back to normal? And what can we do to get murder and other violent crime rates back down? Our next guest has some answers about that. We're joined by Patrick Sharkey, professor of sociology and social policy at Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. Hey, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So before we talk about why it's happening, can you give us a sense of exactly what's happening? Because the data on crime is so annoyingly fragmented. We don't have really good week-to-week national data on it. What's your sense of what kinds of crime actually are up over what period and by how much?
Yeah, so the most important thing to point out is that it's gun violence that has risen dramatically in the past year. And let me plug this website I put together called AmericanViolence.org to try to deal with this exact problem, because data from the FBI come out so far after the fact that it's really hard to understand trends in the short term. So there have been a few efforts. Gun Violence Archive does a great job of documenting reports of shootings. And we've drawn on the data that they put forward. Then we draw on police department data from all over the country to try to give the best kind of close to real-time estimates of how gun violence is changing. So that's the first conclusion, is that it's gun violence. It's not all crime that's rising. In fact, overall crime probably dropped last year, but it's gun violence in particular that skyrocketed in 2020. And, you know, to be clear, this continued a trend that has happened since about 2014. 2014 was the low point in the level of, at least the murder rate hit a low point of 4.4 murders for every 100,000 people. 2014 might have been the safest year in the history of the country. But since then, we've seen a gradual rise in violence, and then that really accelerated last year.
And so, I'm sure there are many answers to this question, but why is that happening?
Yeah, we don't know. Violence is an extremely complicated phenomenon, and it's what makes it so, it's like an epidemic. You know, violence has to be studied as an emergent phenomenon. And the reason I say that is because when there is a surge in violence, it builds on itself. It creates reprisals. It changes the way that people behave. So it's not like you can point to a given factor, say this caused the rise in violence. If this goes away, then violence will fall. Violence cascades. It occurs through systems of interactions. So that makes it really complicated to study. And it also means that rigorous research takes a while to carry out. So lots of different forms of data from last year are being collected. But right now, we're really still in the stage of kind of pointing to theory about what makes violence rise or fall, and then looking at what happened last year and getting some hints about what might have generated. And, you know, there are some obvious clues as to what happened last year. We obviously had the pandemic, which didn't just change everyday life, but really shut down the core institutions that provide the foundation for every community. So that was a major shock that happened in March. To go along with that, we had just this huge surge of gun purchasing. And so the prevalence of guns, more people bought guns last year than at any point in the history of the country. So the surge of guns out into American public space, the disruption to daily life through the pandemic, and then the shock that occurred in late May when the video of George Floyd being murdered was disseminated across the country, and the outbreak of responses to that video and the subsequent response from police officers really changed the trajectory of violence. So that was a point where violence really started to skyrocket in lots of cities across the country.
So, Pat, could I ask you to go a little deeper on the, I mean, because I think the lockdowns, taking people, taking kids out of school, taking people away from places where they would interact with neighbors in a social way, really could have fed the antisocial behavior that we see. And if you see, like, robberies went down. Robbery, like, you get money out of that. There's almost a purpose, to put it bluntly, crassly, of crime. But the antisocial crimes, you know, a murder, an assault, that sort of thing, they went up. And it seems that we have institutions, we have communities, we have churches and libraries and schools that socialize people, and that we might have gotten broadly unsocialized by having to lock in our homes. Is the data consistent with that theory?
Yeah, I mean, I think decades of data tell us that communities become vulnerable to violence when core institutions break down. When people are not interacting with each other, when they don't know each other, when they feel abandoned and left on their own, when they're not going to religious institutions on the weekend, when libraries are shut down. You know, this creates the conditions for people to feel like they're on their own, for people to not interact in, and really, you know, for young people to not have a place to go. When after-school programs shut down, when schools shut down, when libraries shut down and playgrounds and parks. This is not just about, you know, having fun or learning. It's about the types of institutions that hold a community together. And so that shock that occurred in March, it was not just about, you know, material or suffering or physical suffering. It was about a fundamental shift in the daily patterns of everyday life, which are always structured by community institutions. And so, Tim, I think you're exactly right that when those institutions shut down, it changed the way people interact in a way that, you know, you have to read the history of social theory on how communities work in order to, you know, get beyond the idea that it was just about physical or material hardship, that it was really about how people interact together. And I think that's the part that initially created the conditions for neighborhoods to become vulnerable to a rise in violence.
Liz, one thing Patrick notes here is that the great difficulty, the unusually great difficulty of figuring out why this is happening and, you know, which factors are important and how to address them. And I think in the way that has shaped the political conversation is it sort of allowed people to focus on whatever hobby horses they had previously, to pick and choose, you know, how they want to talk about crime in order to further an agenda that they basically already had. And I'm wondering, coming at it from the left, what do you make of this issue, which obviously, as we've talked about policing over the last year, you want to both protect people from being abused by the state and officers of the state, and you also want the state to protect people from being abused by each other. What does it mean to look at this rise in crime as a leftist and talk about what you want the government to do about it?
As a leftist, the way I always look at it, the way I look at every issue at this point is it's worthwhile to just try to figure out what the truth is because it's going to catch up with you anyway. So you just want to beat it to the punch because you can try to spin it. The truth is going to catch up with you. And then you're going to have to deal with the fact that you tried to spin it and you were wrong, and you're still going to have to deal with the truth. So it makes sense to just try to get to the truth right away. So I'm just trying to understand what's going on. The left traditionally looks at crime as a phenomenon that has to do with major inequality. This is one of the arguments of The Spirit Level, which is a great book. It looks at societies that have higher levels of inequality. They tend to have higher levels of crime. I think that's certainly an aspect. I think there's also just sort of an ineffable quality that certain societies have, certain levels of antagonism that others don't. I think introducing high levels of guns, you know, it reminds me of the blade itself incites to violence, right? This line from Homer. When you have a ton of guns around, it's, you know what they're there for, and they themselves kind of incite to use them. And they will eventually be used. And then, you know, you have material deprivation itself, regardless of inequality. You have heat, you have environmental factors, you have pollution, you have stuff in the water, especially in urban areas. I mean, I think it's so multifarious. I'm just trying to understand what change that could lead to a specific spike starting in 2014. That's what I don't really have my arms around. And whatever it is, I just want to know about it because hopefully we can repair it.
Patrick, going back to that trough in at least murders in 2014, I know you note that the data of what's happened in the last year and a half is obviously very new and it's going to take time to collect and analyze it. What about the data going back 7 years? Do you have a clearer sense of why crime started rising or violent crime, gun crime started rising in 2014?
Well, I think we need to go back a little bit further and recognize, you know, so I wrote a book about the drop in violence from the early 90s through roughly 2014 and basically made the case that a whole set of changes took place where public space was transformed. And so that included police officers getting more resources and changing their tactics in a lot of places in a very ruthless, brutal way to retake public space and to shut down open air drug markets. And that came with more aggressive prosecution and mass incarceration. That came also with enhancement in private security, but it also came with this mobilization among the nonprofit sector, among residents and the organizations that lead them in their communities. And that the proliferation of community organizations is left out of discussions about why violence fell. But the empirical work I do suggests that the growth in the nonprofit sector played a causal role, played a substantial role in contributing to the decline of violence. So all those things were taking place at the same time in the early 1990s, contributed to the drop all the way through 2014. What we didn't do as violence was low is we didn't change the way that we responded to violence. So as violence fell, American cities did not move away from that style of brute force policing and aggressive prosecution and mass incarceration and intensive surveillance. A new model did not emerge. And so all the resentment, all the harm that came from communities that were subject to these forms of very brutal policing and this really draconian approach to locking everyone up who is a potential troublemaker and really creating communities that were close to police states. That's not an exaggeration. We didn't shift from that model. We didn't invest in a new model that would deal with extreme urban inequality by investing in institutions, by investing in community organizations. So the argument that I make in the book, the reason I called my book Uneasy Peace is because, yes, all these forces contributed to the fall in violence from the 1990s to the mid-2010s, but they didn't solve the bigger challenge. What do you do when you have extreme urban inequality? And we continued to rely on the police and the prison system as the dominant responses to dealing with extreme urban inequality. And that's never been a sustainable approach because it tears apart communities, it creates resentment, it creates anger, and it's justified anger, and it enhances inequality. So when you have entire communities where a large portion of residents are incarcerated, that doesn't just affect those who are incarcerated. It affects the entire environment. It affects the next generation. So because we have never made the investments to deal with extreme urban inequality, because we haven't invested in community institutions, we always had an unsustainable response. And I think the consequences of that approach, that unsustainable approach, have been borne out in the years since as the resentment toward this model has grown. And we've just seen the consequences of that over the past few years.
So what should local officials do right now? I mean, they can't wait for the full analysis of the data that we've had in the last 18 months. I live in New York. We're in the middle of a mayor's race right now, and the top issue that the candidates are arguing about is crime and what to do about it. And you have talk about, you know, should we be diverting money that's currently used for policing for other resources that are supposed to get at the root causes of crime? Do we need more cops on the streets? What should they be doing with the limited evidence that they have available to them? What do you do if you're taking over in a city just as we're coming out of this pandemic? And we started by talking about the disruption of those social institutions. Can they assume that whatever damage was caused by the disruption of those institutions will just reverse itself as people get back into school and into church and whatever it was that they were previously doing? Or is that something that, you know, is going to have a lasting effect that we need some specific policy to fight against?
So New York is a good example. I wrote a report with Elizabeth Glazer, who's ran the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice for 6 years under de Blasio. And we start by pointing out the changes that took place in New York, since the time of Bloomberg, where the city basically ended the use of stop, question, and frisk almost entirely. The number of arrests dropped substantially over time. The jail population dropped to levels that are more similar to Western Europe than they are to the rest of the U.S. And violence kept falling and falling. The reason it was falling is because the city was investing in a new style of policing. They created this position of neighborhood coordination officers whose job was not to enforce the law, but whose job was to rebuild trust. They created a program called Neighborhood Stat, which was designed to bring the leaders of a community together with law enforcement and to gather data and have discussions about the problems, what was creating problems in the community. Okay, so all of these changes were taking place. There was no rise in violence. Violence kept falling to historically low levels. The progress that was made is easy to forget, you know, after we went through last year. But I do think of it as a proof of concept. When you invest in core community institutions, when you invest in a new style of policing that is designed around building trust and legitimacy, violence will fall. Okay, we have a model. We have lots of evidence, decades of evidence, and it's very rigorous evidence from, you know, randomized controlled trials telling us when you redesign abandoned lots and abandoned buildings, violence falls. When you give kids high quality after school programs, violence falls. When you give kids summer jobs and combine it with cognitive behavioral therapy, violence falls. So we have a model, but there's this knee-jerk reaction that's always been in place in the U.S. for the past 60 years and much longer. But at least this has been the model for the past 60 years. When there's a surge in violence, turn to the police, turn to the prison system. This is our automatic response. And it is not a response that is driven by evidence. It is not a response that is represents the only way to deal with violence, but it's just the way that our politics have responded to the issues of violence and all of the issues that come bundled when you have extreme urban inequality. This has been the knee-jerk response. So we're already seeing it. You see it in the New York City mayor's race. You see it in cities across the country. As violence has risen, the automatic response is to turn back to the police.
Professor Patrick Sharkey of Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, it's your soapbox.
I'm tired of media outlets turning what should be an opinion piece into something with bolder claims to the truth, such as a fact check or calling something misinformation, which they simply think is wrong. My favorite or least favorite fact check from coronavirus was from National Public Radio saying, fact check, Trump praises Florida governor despite criticism of coronavirus response. And of course, my least favorite thing being branded disinformation or misinformation was the hypothesis that coronavirus might have leaked out of a lab. That is now widely held up to be a plausible theory. So maybe a little bit of humility and a little of the old-fashioned media idea of if you don't like something, write an opinion piece saying we think this idea is bad, rather than trying to brand it as off-limits or simply wrong.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
I'm tired of hearing about ecosystems and how delicate they are, how it might knock something out of balance down the line, including bats, which, by the way, shouldn't be around anyway, and I have my sights set on them next. Folks, it's time to kill every mosquito in the world. Every summer I suggest this. Every 4 years I suggest a president run on it. Pretty soon I'm going to be old enough to run for president myself. I plan to run on killing every mosquito in the world, and I will win at least 48 states if someone doesn't beat me to it first, and I hope they will.
For my rant, we had another big cyber attack this week against JBS, the Brazilian meatpacker that produces nearly a quarter of U.S. beef. The company's American plants were offline for a few days. They've been opening back up as we get to the end of the week. This problem is hard, as Kim Zetter described to us a few weeks ago. Cybersecurity is hard. Identifying and prosecuting hackers in foreign countries that protect them is hard. But there's another tool we should use on our own shores. We must stop U.S. companies and other U.S. entities from paying ransoms. The point of ransomware is the ransom. And if U.S. firms aren't allowed to pay ransoms, they won't be attractive targets. We can stop them from paying. These ransoms are often millions of dollars. A lot of employees are involved in paying. Banks are involved. We have an advanced system for supervising bank transactions, flagging suspicious ones, and we can say to these companies, hey, that IT outage you had, was that ransomware? Did you send a few million dollars in Bitcoin to these people? That's illegal. And then we can fine them. We can put people in jail. We can stop people from doing this. And if we do that, then the hackers will have to look elsewhere because U.S. firms won't be attractive targets anymore. This can protect us all by stopping anyone from paying the hackers what they're looking for. This is all we have time for today. I want to thank Liz Brunig, Tim Carney, and Patrick Sharkey. Left, Right, and Center was produced this week by Rebecca Mooney and recorded and mixed by Kat Yore. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
From PRX.